Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to provide people who have lost everything with, at the very least, a safe and decent place to sleep at night? For millions of people in disaster areas, war zones, and the developing world, a resource as basic as durable protection from the elements is prohibitively expensive if it's available at all. But through the collaborative humanitarian efforts of engineers, architects, and entrepreneurs, it may be possible to provide people with affordable shelter that can be built from the ground up within hours and last a decade or more. My two guests are here to talk about that. Andrew Crixall is Assistant Professor of Engineering at the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. Ronald Omyanga is an architect from Kenya who is in town to speak on the topic of equitable design, a holistic solution to housing, on the invitation of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. That lecture takes place this afternoon at 4:30 on the SMU campus. Andrew, Ronald, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having us.
So,
thank you.
What is humanitarian engineering?
Well, Ronald, if I can start with that, and if you have anything, please jump in and say something. I'm with SMU and the Lyle School of Engineering, but I'm also with the Hunt Institute, and that's actually just getting off the ground, and it's very exciting. It's part of the Lyle School. Lyle School has this mission that they want to reinvent what engineering education is, and part of that, part of the drive that they have, is to include humanitarian efforts. Take engineers, classic education for engineers, and attack humanitarian problems. And so humanitarian engineering or social engineering allows us to work with people like Ronald, and we're very fortunate to find him, to start working on problems such as equitable design.
Yeah, I think for me, humanitarian engineering is more like, you know, when people think about engineering and most of the technical fields, people think of serious high-tech problems, and they think that's what engineers are supposed to be doing. And humanitarian engineering is all about taking all that complex knowledge and solving what seems to be like very, very basic, but yet very, very serious problems. And so that is more like downgrading or downloading, bringing the technology you have from that high level and solving what are the most basic world problems. And it takes a bit of re-engineering your mind to be able to bring down that technology of yours and your expertise to solve the very, very basic problems. And I think that's what the Hunt Institute is all about.
Well, what's interesting about that is you talk about solving these very basic problems. A lot of engineers are trained to have the best equipment at their disposal and the best materials and resources. And in a case like this, where you're looking at providing housing and clean water sources in places where these things don't exist, all of a sudden many of those tools are unavailable.
Absolutely, and that's part of what we are trying to get across in the curriculum that would be associated with this. Is certainly at SMU and the Lyle School and elsewhere in engineering education, it's cutting edge, it's high tech, it's putting in the classroom and even outside the classroom the highest end technology possible and getting students trained on that. That's fabulous. We need to have that. What we're getting at and what Ronald is discussing is we also need the other. Let's pick that up and let's put that in the slums of Nairobi or in Western Kenya in the Rift Valley. It's not quite transportable. So how do we take the education we're giving those students and provide them the tools, both physically, the technological tools, and the soft skills to be able to go to those different environments and work?
Ronald, do you see this as an ethical obligation for engineers and architects and other people with the skills to make a difference?
Yes, I think it's an ethical obligation because I think no profession was just made or designed for only a certain class of people. I don't think that engineering or architecture, for that matter, was put in place just for the rich. And when I take my example, like back in Kenya, the resources that educated me to become an architect were drawn from taxpayers' money, and taxpayers' money are not just the rich or the sophisticated members of the society. It's also the very, very basic, you know, the people who are facing the most serious problems. And so I think it's an obligation to us, beyond even ethics, that really if you have been educated to get certain kind of education, and if that education cannot be used to solve the problems of the masses, then you have to go back to the drawing board and repackage that to be able to be useful to the very, very basic level. And for me, it's not a matter of choice. It's a matter of something we have to do.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your background, because the fact that you were sitting here is a pretty remarkable thing. And I understand that you have a mother who was essentially a force of nature when you were growing up, but had a great strength of will, not a lot of money, single mother. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, I was brought up, I was born as the last born of a family of four sons and raised by a single mother. And my mother just emphasized to us that the only way we were going to get out of the poverty we were in was through education. When I grew up, I didn't feel really poor because the people who lived around me were actually surviving the same way. We didn't have shoes and it didn't matter. We ran to school sometimes in a pair of shorts or in a shirt, but that didn't really matter. It felt normal. But we knew that out there was nice life we were aspiring to, and my mother showed us that for us, the only way hope we had was through education. And since we didn't have a father, we had to work very hard in school. And so although my mother was, and she's still living, she's not educated, she can't speak English. She had a way of finding out which grades we got. And if you brought on bad grades, you'd just be whipped the hell out of you. So that really scared us. And so I went to school really working very hard to try and become the best person I could get. I left school, primary school in my rural area, and was lucky enough because I performed relatively well and was picked to go to this high school. In Kenya, we have a league of schools that are called national schools. They select the best students from all over the country. So I went to a high school that had really a good tradition. And I went there for 4 years, was taught a bit of sophistication. I think most of the things I know today I learned while I was in high school. And I also learned this. One of the great things about my school was we had this motto, strong to serve. And we were being prepared as men who will serve God and serve man. And so I think that really injected in me this spirit that I wanted to serve God and serve man. And so when I qualified and went to school, and after that I went and studied for 6 years to become an architect. I chose being an architect because it was a way of ensuring that I got a job that could make me make money, mm-hmm. and just meet my mother's dream of actually getting out of poverty. But as soon as I studied architecture and learned all the complex architecture, learned about Frank Lloyd Wright, Le Corbusier, and the Chicago School of Architecture and all that. And it was exciting. But when I got out of school, I all of a sudden I realized that architecture could not serve most of the people I knew or most of the people I saw growing up. And I really got frustrated. And so I started thinking from that point, I needed to make that architecture I'd learned more relevant to the people I knew. Yeah, and so that's how I think I ended up here. Yeah.
Let's talk just for a minute about this issue of internally displaced persons, or IDPs. Latest estimates are that there are more than 27 million people in the world who are not in the homes they would like to be, and they have been displaced by war, by poverty, by natural disaster. What kind of housing exists for them in most of those places?
Yeah, you know, most of the places where we have internally displaced people and refugees, they normally, you know, the international organizations treat that as emergencies, and they set it up in three phases. So they talk about the emergency immediately after the disaster, what happens. They bring in a tent that, you know, can be put up pretty fast. It's light, and the durability is not an issue because they expect the emergency will not last more than 3 months. Mm-hmm. So if you have something that lasts around 3 months, it's okay. But normally the experience has been that it lasts longer than 3 months.
Years, decades in some cases.
Years and decades. And what happens is that then they move to a step they call the transitional shelter. And transitional shelter is where they start thinking, now we need to supply a bit of building materials, maybe roofing sheets and such kind of materials, and let the members, the people who have been displaced, use them to construct some shelters as they wait to be resettled. And finally, if this works, they normally have to be taken back to where they used to be, and they need to be given a resettlement package. And so for us, when we sat down to start thinking about, when we were designing the habitat, we thought of one solution that could run through the three steps so that you came up with a facility that could come up as easily and quickly as a tent, but offer more comfortable living space, offer more roof height, you know, in terms of a more comfortable living space with storage space, which is stiff, that when it rains, it cannot be blown away by the wind and things like that. And then that could last long enough to go through the transitional period so that if this emergency lasted more than 3 years, you still have a house you're living on that is still pretty in good shape. Mm-hmm. And if by a lucky chance that within the remaining 10 or so years, you are to be resettled, you could still carry the same house and take it to your original home, and you don't need to have any other starter kit. You can still start life with the same house. So we basically were thinking of one technology that can meet the three stages of an emergency with one, you know, one solution. Yeah, maybe.
Which is exactly how we found Ronald. Mm-hmm. The mission of the Hunt Institute is to look for such technologies, not necessarily grow them in-house, but to go out and collaborate and find those. And a new focus in the Hunt Institute is working with refugees and IDPs. And when we did a little research on that, we quickly found, actually, Ronald and Habba Hutt, as he referenced a minute ago, which I think we'll hear more about in a moment. And we were so excited and thrilled that for other reasons in a trip to Nairobi, we were able to visit Ronald there, and that's how we built this relationship.
Well, it really is an elegant solution, and people can find pictures of this online. But talk for a minute, Andrew, about the first time you saw the Habba Hutt. What struck you about it? First of all, we should probably describe what it looks like, and then talk about why you thought, my God, this is brilliant.
Sure, I'd love to. I will give my take on it because I'm sure it will be a different take, a non-architect take. I'd also love to get Ronald's. I'm sure he could give you the
details.
They're
actually quite beautiful as well, which is might surprise people.
They are, and if I had to describe it, it's the stark contrast in which I saw it. Mm-hmm. Because where we saw it was not on the YouTube video that you can go look at or standing in a field somewhere. We saw it, what I would say, in situ. Has been first applied by Ronald and his colleagues in slums in Nairobi. So I first met Ronald, actually, through some emails and let's be honest, a Google search prior to mm-hmm. that. But where I first met him physically was in an alley in Korocho, which is one of the slums of Nairobi.
We should say Nairobi is considered one of the most dangerous cities in Africa.
I don't know that Ronald would pass that on, but yes, it's known for that. It certainly is one of the major metropolitan areas internationally that is known for its slums as well. Right. And we went to one of them. Korocho is the name of it, and we met Ronald there. We agreed to meet there. Honestly, we didn't know we were going to a slum. Mm-hmm. We knew we were meeting Ronald. We knew we were going to see this product in the field. We didn't know where that field was. And we met him on a small alleyway, which we walked down. It was covered with refuse, lots of kids and families running around. It's the classic image of a large metropolitan slum in the third world, which can be described by the refuse on the ground, the smell of burning, and the corrugated metal, everything mm-hmm. made of rusting corrugated metal. So put that in your mind, and then look on the horizon of the thin alley, where you see a gleaming white pointed structure.
Let me have you stop right there, yeah. And you can tell us a little bit more in a minute, and we'll hear from Ronald as well. My guests this hour are Andrew Quicksall, who is Assistant Professor of Engineering at SMU, and Ronald Omyanga, who is an architect. Both will speak this afternoon on equitable design as part of a project of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. That address takes place at 4:30. You can find a link to it, to more information, on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Architect Ronald Omyanga is here, along with engineer Andrew Quicksall of SMU. Both will be speaking this afternoon on equitable design, a holistic solution to housing, at the invitation of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. That address takes place at 4:30 on the SMU campus. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Andrew, you left us with the perfect tease. You're walking us through this Nairobi slum, and then on the horizon you see this gleaming white structure.
It's true, and I don't mean to overstate it, but it's truly what we saw. You walk down with corrugated metal rusting around you, and literally walking over refuse. And what we approached was a schoolyard. It's actually another nonprofit there that's run by another gentleman, and that group leased out some space to Ronald and his group to erect a Hapa hut there. And we'll talk about why in a moment. But again, it's this stark image, this gleaming white synthetic material rising above the corrugated rusting roofs. And that would be the first impression of the Hapa hut. Now, upon closer inspection and moving up to it, it's both simplistic yet advanced at the same time, which I know sounds strange, but it feels so advanced, the material, the quality of the construction, considering what was around, yeah. The juxtaposition. But the simplicity, both in how it is set up, but also the clean construction that it is also very apparent when you approach it.
It's some kind of translucent plastic with a steel frame, is that right?
Yeah, it is. It lets in a bit of light. The panels let in a bit of light, but the structure is actually aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And that we selected because we wanted to achieve lightweightness, the fact that we want something that can be carried easily. And it just comes in panels and bits. As Andrew said, there are no roads in the slums, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want something that you can carry in pieces and erect quickly without having to have too much space. Another thing is that, as Andrew says, it's advanced, but it's put up very easily using just simple tools. And that was also by design. So we were basically trying to put up something that looked nice. Because, sometimes people think that just because you've been displaced or you are a refugee, you do not have a right or you do not even deserve some levels of dignity
and privacy.
And privacy, and also a feeling of appreciation for aesthetics. Architects are obsessed with trying to touch people's emotions. So, this structure, although it's supposed to be utilitarian, it's also supposed to serve to show this guy that, yes, you're not in your home, but you're at least somewhere you can close a door.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit of a lock on it compared to a tent where you don't know when you're asleep, somebody can walk right in. And the issue of people who are displaced and refugees is something that people need to think through. You can imagine that you are in your home today, a comfortable home to some standard, and the following day you find yourself on the street without somewhere to sleep and you're living in a tent. So I feel that you can never do too much for someone like that, because what they have lost is already too much. So we were just trying to do, we have a budget to control, but we're also trying to achieve some level of a good architecture and just sensitive design to them to meet the challenges of a solution like that.
What's it like on the inside?
On the inside, it's really, we have like 100 square foot, 118 square foot of floor space. It has a good height that you can stand in there, and you can even have some space to hang some goods up there. If you compare it to the tent that they now have, that you can't stand in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
You actually always seated down. So this provides a space that you can walk around. There are windows to it, and there's ventilation to it. So it really provides a good cool environment, and the panels are such that they are UV resistant, and they also don't let in too much heat, and so that creates an environment that is much more comfortable to live in. It's much cooler at night, and it's not too hot during the day.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to join the conversation to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone first to Harvey in Josephine. Hi, Harvey.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Ronald.
Hi,
Harvey. Harvey from last night.
Hi, thanks.
I told you I'd try to call in. I see you got us an engineer to talk to us.
Yeah, you know, architects are nothing without engineers.
What Ronald and myself was talking about last night would be how neat it would be to Kenya, like the United States, like Mexico, like every other country in the world. In fact, it's like the oceans, has a problem with plastics. Okay?
Yep.
What I've envisioned would be a simple machine that would convert recycled plastic into a building material. So if we was to introduce this to a slum in Kenya, what we would have would be these machines where that some of the people would be able to make a living by scrapping, not unlike our the people you see in South Dallas running around with the grocery carts looking for aluminum cans. Mm-hmm. But what they'd be looking for would be cleaning up the area, trying to find the plastics. They bring the plastics to somebody, an entrepreneur that has this machine, and they sell the recyclable plastic. The plastic is then converted into a building material, which is sold to contractors. And then contractors sell houses to the people. We start from the bottom up, because that way we're starting a vertical orientation between peoples instead of the horizontal, which is what we have with charity and aid.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's something that I'm really excited about. And that's really what the Hunt Institute is about. It's about bringing the best in terms of technology and linking that with business solutions so that you are able to create jobs. You are able to create these linkages. And that's why we are talking about equitable design, a design that not only provides a good technology, but a technology that can also create jobs, generate incomes, create businesses. It's also a technology that can solve other problems, like what Harvey is talking about, the problem of waste, you know, plastic waste. And one of the things we are emphasizing, and what I'll still be talking about during my talk today, is how we need to turn what looks like challenges into solutions, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. that can then solve what we thought are really problems and just turn that into something exciting. So I'm really excited about his comments. Maybe Andrew?
Yeah, and what I would add to that is that, first of all, on your specific suggestion of using plastics, scrapping is done quite a bit in the third world and in Nairobi and in the slums. As soon as it is profitable to drive plastic scrapping into reforming materials for building processes, it will happen. Mm-hmm. It will be driven by the profit that those individuals could have. Now, you might be able to play a hand and force that with policy, but that's not in place as of yet, and perhaps that's what you're suggesting. But there is something else in place that we haven't discussed yet, and it's actually where I most overlap with Ronald, and that is by water delivery. So Habahud itself is a great structure, and has been designed for housing solutions. That's certainly what the talk will be on or centered on later. I'm not an engineer that builds houses. I actually look at clean water. And when I found the first implementation of Habahud with Ronald in Korosho in the slum, it was actually being used as a water distribution point. And so my personal excitement, not just on behalf of the Hunt Institute, but for Andrew Quixall, I got very excited.
Well, let me ask you about that, because my understanding is there are water distribution points in a lot of places where there aren't necessarily wells available to the general public, but it sometimes takes a long time to build them. Is that part of the challenge?
Certainly. And for the policy half of that, moving it into the slums, I'll let Ronald comment on that in a moment, but some of the challenges that exist regardless I'll use Korosho as an example. We can use Nairobi water, public water, and pump it into slums and have a wellhead. But some of the major problems can come even post-construction. First of all is how do you pay back Nairobi water for putting that in and for continued use if they get paid back at all? Secondly, how do we keep it clean? Mm-hmm. A lot of contamination and eventual illness that would come from waterborne disease is post-pumping. It's right there at the wellhead with contamination or ponded water that's below it. Lastly, how do you keep it secure? How do you keep profiteering from happening? Someone can come in, utilize that point of use for their own profit, and how do we keep it secure so that it's open to anyone at the same level? We found Ronald dealing with all of those problems simultaneously using the Habahud design.
Housing. Housing is not just housing, but it also comes with the support facilities that come with housing. And some of the challenges that slums have is not just the houses themselves, but it's access to basic services like water, sanitation, and things like that. And I've spent lots of time just working in slums trying to address that. And one of the challenges that we have is how do you supply water sustainably and using a business model to a slum. And like the slums in Africa and in Nairobi, for example, lie on land that has no security of tenure. And so they also don't have like layouts in terms of planning that can enable you to lay pipes mm-hmm. to go to specific houses. And even if you are going to lay pipes, these are people who do not legally own the space they're living on. So how are you going to lay pipes on land which they don't officially own? So what the government started doing is that they needed to think through how they can deliver water to the people who live in the slums, because as a matter of human rights, from a human rights point of view, people who live in the slums have also a right to access water. But, you know, then you have to balance the issues of affordability and issues of sustainability. So what was happening is that most of the slums in Nairobi had business vendors who would come in with water and charge exorbitant prices and sell the water to the slum dwellers. And so what we did is that when we set up the Habitat in Nairobi for a demonstration, one of the water companies looked at it and said, oh my, that can serve as a water kiosk.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. And then we started thinking now about the Habitat as a water kiosk. And we worked with the Water Services Trust Fund to try and just work on the basic design of having the Habitat serve as a water kiosk. And so what Andrew saw was really an example of a water kiosk in place. And a water kiosk is based on the principle that the Nairobi Water Company or the water company in any part of the world delivers water to a certain point to an entrepreneur or an enterprising group that is organized, and then they charge water usage and put a meter on that so that they charge the entrepreneur for the water that is supplied. And then the entrepreneur goes ahead and sells water to the users around. And so he sells it at a profit that it enables him to pay back the bills mm-hmm. and also be in business. And because he's selling water that is directly drawn from the water company, which is a pseudo-government agency, what happens is that his prices are also controlled so that he cannot exploit the farmers, the slum dwellers. But at the same point, he's able to sustain a good business and basically really turn a problem, which was really a water problem, into a job opportunity for somebody who otherwise didn't have a job.
It sounds like it might be a great opportunity to incorporate micro-lending structures.
Yeah, that's something that we've been thinking about at Habitat, and we've been trying to develop some ideas about micro-lending about this. But we think that this is an opportunity for Hunt Institute with the people they'll be bringing together, you know, because I look at the Hunt Institute as a multidisciplinary institute that will bring in not just engineers, but bring in sociologists, bring in economists, bring in all people who think about the problems that face the world. And then we can develop multidisciplinary solutions to this. And you see, that's again what we are talking about, holistic. So it's not just about a technological solution, but this has to be backed up by a financial innovation, a financing mechanism that is innovative, a business model that is innovative. And so there's space for everyone, and even, you know, a sociological innovation in terms of how do we deliver that and mm-hmm. organize communities mm-hmm. to be able to participate in this process. So there is space actually for everyone to come and bring in the expertise, and then at the end of it, we'll have a solution that should be exciting to look at, and it will be neither engineering nor it will just be a solution that is innovative.
And I would absolutely echo that, and particularly the interdisciplinary nature. As an example, that this water project right here, at first glance, Ronald and I may have a lot in common in our disciplines, an architect and a civil engineer. In reality, Ronald's an architect and I'm a water chemist. And so when you look a bit deeper, we may not have much in common. until we go after a problem that brings us together interdisciplinarily. And that's where we are, trying to solve problems with water.
Yeah.
How important is it that you consult with the people who will benefit from these innovations?
Yeah, wow. That is actually the core of any success to this. I have been involved before in Engineers Without Borders and many other projects that involve technical solutions and transfer of technology. And what you finally come to is that most of the problems we face is that we end up having a project that is actually a sociology project with an engineering aspect to it.
Yeah.
So although it starts off as an engineering project, the sociological problem, you know, the sociology point of it, the issues that go with just talking with communities, going through the process of organizing them. For example, where Andrew visited, this was a youth group. Mm-hmm. It's a youth group that has to be organized to run this project and deliver water services to the people. And do that as a business, you know, that creates jobs to the youth group. And so the youth group has to undergo training in terms of business management. And it has also to go through training in terms of operations and maintenance. And so there is always an opportunity for you to link up with other nonprofits that then facilitate the issue of community organizing. So you cannot walk away from community organizing. And that's what we're talking about, re-engineering the whole process. And the engineer has to change and become a bit of a sociologist. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be the challenge. You know, actually, I have gone to site as an architect in my work and ended up doing very little architecture.
And a lot of sociology.
Yeah. And you realize that I talk more than I draw nowadays, mm-hmm. because that's really what it comes down to, that you first need to talk to the people. You have to win their confidence. You have to start seeing the problems of their point of view, and they have to trust you. They have to know that you're on their side. And you'll finally find most of the solutions will come from them. You will just panel beat them using your technical knowledge to create a solution.
Architect Ronald Omyanga and engineer Andrew Quicksall are here. Both will be speaking this afternoon at the request of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Architect Ronald Omyanga is my guest this afternoon, along with Andrew Quicksall, who is assistant professor at the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. Both will speak this afternoon at 4:30 on the SMU campus about equitable design, a holistic solution to housing. We have an email here from Janice, who wants to know whether this has been executed beyond Nairobi. Is anyone financing more of the Haba Huts? Janice is also looking for a picture. We've linked on our homepage, on our Think page, to the video that you referred to earlier, Andrew, so you can check it out there, think@kera.org. Actually, that's our email address, kera.org/think. Anyway, let's talk about the money, because I was amazed to hear that these are, you can now deliver one for about $2,500?
Yes.
And a whole village for $200,000 with 50 families' homes?
Yes. Habiat is really still very young company, and we have started this, and Nairobi was like our first place we were trying to test this. We've also sent at least one unit to Haiti to try and just test that in the field. So our goal is to go global and create something that functions all over the world. We started with Nairobi because, of course, Kenya hosts one of the highest populations of refugees in the world. Mm-hmm. And so that was a good place to go learning. But we are thinking global. And right now we are trying out the village in a box. We have our pilot project at Vumilia. Vumilia is one of the camps that was set up after the post-election violence in Kenya that displaced hundreds of thousands of people. And so Vumilia is a Swahili word that translates basically to perseverance.
Mm-hmm.
And so this group of people are living together, and they've been living in this tent since 2008. And so we just wanted to try out this idea of a village in a box. The village in a box idea is whereby a 14-foot container can bring in a complete village, so to speak, that hosts 50 families and comes together with businesses, you know, businesses that can sell water, they can sell shower services, toilet services, also or provide mobile phone charging and any other facility that we would like to offer to our community. So we are trying to experiment with what can be called a self-sustaining village that brings together 50 units. And so at this point, we are trying to fundraise as Hubby Hut to just have a chance to pilot this,
mm-hmm.
where we have the whole group of 50 units working together and see how that turns out. So we will be very grateful at this point to have a chance to test that out. Yes.
And if I can add a different direction in answer there, and I'll take the liberty of slightly speaking for Ronald here, and then I'll speak for myself, and that is Ronald is not only associated with Hubby Hut. We do have other projects and things in common, and certainly for the Hunt Institute, we're very interested in Ronald and what he does in Hubby Hut and what they provide. But to answer the question on where else besides Nairobi, we are starting a partnership and have built a partnership with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, UNHCR, and that certainly is a global entity, and it's why we really got to Nairobi to begin with, and I can explain that more, and it's how we actually found Ronald, and it's a commonality we have. And with that program and what we're doing with them, we're looking at housing, but we're also looking at water and sanitation issues, and we're really looking in Kenya broadly, but also refugee camps worldwide.
How effective is UNHCR at doing away with bureaucracy when you have any kind of gigantic organization, even one that is set up with the intention of doing very good things for people in need? Things can get hung up in red tape.
They can, and one of the biggest hang-ups is not just with UNHCR. The difficulty of working with refugee populations, let alone IDP populations, is that it's not just UNHCR. They don't have sole dominion over the processes that affect these peoples. They have the mandate of the UN to be in charge, but of course they're at the pleasure at the host of the host nation, and working that politic between UNHCR and, as an example, Kenya can be quite difficult. And a lot of the holdup that may actually impact the people in the camps or those trying to get into the camps can be between the host nation and UNHCR. So while UNHCR certainly has bureaucracy and it has some internal workings that slow things down, there's this other component that often gets glossed over that is a huge issue, and that's working between host nations and UNHCR.
Ronald, can you talk about where you think the balance should lie between really helping people who are in great need and also fostering personal responsibility?
Yeah, I think there's there needs to be a neat balance over that. That there's a time when people need to be helped because they're really helpless, but we need to focus more on building their capacity to help themselves mm-hmm. beyond that. And my belief, which goes beyond even the issues of just refugees and IDPs, and it goes beyond to even people living in the slums, I think the approach to development should shift from aid to more of empowering or enabling processes that help to create income, to create jobs, and help people to move themselves from poverty, as opposed to trying to just, you know, it's kind of like giving them a fish and keeping them down there. I prefer a situation where you start teaching them how to fish, even if it means you teach fewer people at a time. You'll be sure that when you teach one person to fish, it's not just him you'll be feeding. He'll be feeding more people. So I think it doesn't sound very nice, because most people want to hear that we've given, you know, handouts are popular.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to think strategic. And I finally believe that the solutions, sustainability can only be achieved through the marketplace. And so we need to start thinking about how we can develop business solutions that can then address poverty. I don't think poverty will ever be addressed through the handout culture. Yeah.
How common is it for people with backgrounds like yours who have been fortunate enough and have worked hard enough to get this great education to turn back around and commit their lives to helping those communities? It would seem maybe not honorable, but very tempting to just live in the big city. You're making a good living and just sort of forget all that in the past.
Yeah, it's a question I've been asked over and over, and most people sometimes think this guy is a bit crazy. but I think it's a bit addictive, there's something rewarding about changing lives. And for me, I think I'm just a bit of a dreamer and an ambitious one. I think that I would like to leave a better legacy than a high-rise building, a skyscraper. I would like to leave a legacy of this architect who made architecture relevant to the very, very, very poor people. And people started knowing what architects really do. So for me, you can sometimes get tired. You get tempted at some point. And so it's good when I meet people like the Hunt Institute. You know, you for once get people who assure you that you're not really crazy. You're okay. That there are fewer people who think like you. But it's easy for you to get tempted to just sit back and say, okay, I can lead life as an architect. But I still feel I think I'll not be happy doing that. But it takes commitment on you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ronald, you're being quite humble. You may call yourself crazy, but we and many others call you amazing. And Chris, you and your listeners have probably picked up on it, but Ronald is very charismatic and very passionate about what he does. And that came through to us just in an afternoon in an alleyway in a slum, and to the point that we knew we needed him here to come and talk with the different groups that he's been speaking with and to come speak to our students this afternoon. So, Ronald, you're too humble. the likelihood that someone would go for the money as opposed to the direction you have gone, I think we all know, is very high. And Ronald is going in a direction that's very uncommon.
What about this, Andrew? There may be no time in anyone's life other than college and graduate school where they feel more able to change the world and more excited. What does it take to really harness that excitement and that energy and also put a veneer of reality over it all?
Sure. So glad you asked that. And it is an opportunity, and it's something that we have to capitalize on. This is amazing. I'm the faculty advisor for Engineers Without Borders at SMU as well. And last year we had 4 students. This year we have 60.
Wow.
We have a student
body. You might want to talk to our membership department.
That had nothing to do with me and everything to do with the senior students that built that up. But the point is we have a very engaged student body. We have a student body that is not just looking for the technical skills. Mm-hmm. They want that. They get that. That's not a problem. They want to apply that in other ways. They want to give back to community. They want the Ronalds to come and talk to them and to fuel that fire. So what do we need to do? We need to give them an outlet. We need to do the Engineers Without Borders projects, hopefully in Kenya, starting in a year, by the way. We need to work with Habba Hutt on campus and in Kenya. We need to build the partnership with UNHCR and get students involved through research, through study abroad, through extracurricular lectures such as this, and through direct coursework. We need to expand what we're doing to include this realm and just make it available to them, because their energy is going to drive the real output. We don't need to do that. We wind them up and let them go, but we need to give them the sphere to play in.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak to Edie. Hi, Edie in Arlington. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, this is actually, you're already touching into it. I was going to ask the guest that, because I've been in America almost about a little over 20 years. And then for what I've seen, and we all coming over here and getting an opportunity to learn and succeed in our lives. But my question to your guest is, does he really think, what is responsibility to go back home and then nevertheless to go back to be like all the politicians? All they do is just all same old game and destroy the country. And when he goes back, can he really focus on his main idea to bring the change, to improve the young generation, to improve the life in Africa?
Yeah, thanks, Edie. Actually, I'm based in Kenya and I'm just visiting. I was just talking to Chris before this and I told her that I have no intention of leaving Kenya. I would like to continue to be a bridge. And one of the things that has really disappointed me with most of people from Africa who come to study in the U.S. and other parts of the developed world is that they come here and get comfortable and forget where they came from. And I think that's not the role we should be playing. The role we should be playing is that we go get the best we can get from here and go and use that knowledge to try and change the lives of our people. It is a message I would like to preach. It's a message I would like to preach to all Africans in the diaspora. I know it's very easy to come here and just say that you can never do anything in Africa. The politics is not right and everything is not right. But we have to do something. You never really know how hard it is or how easy it is to do something if you don't do something about it. So I am a believer in people trying to use the best skill they've got to change where they live. I'm a believer in developing networks, south-north networks, and south-south networks, networks between technologies, transferring processes to improve the lives of people in Africa. And for me, that's the message I would like to send to anyone who comes from Africa and comes to America or any other part of the developed world. There are great institutions of learning. There are great people who are willing to support us. But I think we have to lead from the front. We are the ones who know the problems. And we are fortunate enough to have gone to school. We have to help our people because they count on us and we need to be there for them.
Is there anything special that you're doing, Ronald, to capitalize on the fact that a lot of Americans are noticing Kenya now because of the president's ancestry?
Yeah, it's a good time to be a Kenyan and to have your name start with O like myself. Yeah, so it's a good time. The country has been doing a lot of effort. And I remember during the last World Tourism exhibition in London, the Kenyan stand had this big picture of the president of the U.S. saying, "Welcome to Kenya, the land of Obama." So that's how serious it is for us, and we're trying to take advantage of it and just to show where Kenya is on the map. And the leadership of Kenya right now is not talking about aid anymore. It's talking about investment opportunities in Kenya. And even as I'm here talking about this project, we are thinking of business solutions, and we are thinking businesses and corporates should partner with institutes like the Hunt Institute. And instead of giving aid, work to develop businesses that can change the world.
Ronald Omyanga is an architect from Kenya. Andrew Quicksall is assistant professor of engineering at SMU. Both will speak this afternoon about equitable design, a holistic solution to housing, on the invitation of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. Gentlemen, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
Chris.
You so
Appreciate
much.
It.
Thank you for having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.